Good morning and welcome to the roundtable panel for this Tuesday, the 12th of August. It's very nice to have you with us. We welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. A reminder, you can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page or even tweet us at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable, that little squiggly at WAMC Roundtable. Good morning. Let me introduce our panel to you. Quite a lineup this morning. First and foremost, Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
And Legislative Director of NYPIRG, the New York Public Interest Research Group, Blair Horner, joins us once again. Good morning, Blair.
Good morning.
And Tech Attorney Rich Honan back in the hot seat this morning. Good morning, Rich.
Good morning.
Partner in charge of Phillips Lytle LLP. And again, we welcome your input, roundtable@wamc.org. We don't have to spend a ton of time on this. I think it's a top story. It was something that, you know, it's one of those stories that kind of, with all that's going on in the world, that you hear and you're like, really? What? Huh? Mm-hmm. What happened? And that was the death of Robin Williams, which broke, I don't know, maybe about 6:30, 7 o'clock last night. And 63 years old, believed to be, took his own life, suicide, had been battling severe depression for the last several weeks, although had several bouts of depression throughout his life, as well as battling various addictions, and most recently in rehab about a month ago for alcohol. And I think any way you look at it, it's a sad story on many levels. And of course, there are the remembrances, and then there's also, you know, just that reminder that, well, first of all, there's two reminders to me. One is that comedians are just tortured souls, aren't they? I don't think.
Well, it seems that way, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah. It really does. And also, of course, that, you know, at 63 years old and still be, by all measures, or by most measures anyway, very successful in your professional life, and still be battling something that compels you to take your own life.
Yeah, you know, the troubling part of it is, I mean, certainly the tributes have been rolling in, and we can't add to what's been said. It's just been so incredible, and the world will miss him. But when you know that somebody has this, you know, these problems of addiction and depression, you think that we can treat that. You know, we can treat. He had open heart surgery a couple of years ago, and he came out of it strong. You know, why can't you stop it? And that's the vexing thing about it. It is so sad, but he was unable to get the help that he needed, and he had all the means to do it, and it's still, he succumbed to, you know, bouts of mental illness, and it cost him his life.
I have to say, I was surprised, and I don't have the numbers in front of me. I was looking for them a moment ago, but I couldn't find them. But last night there was somebody was talking about the percentage of people of post heart surgery of committing suicide with a history of depression and mental illness.
Oh, prior.
Prior. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's very high. And it is an interesting, and of course, you know, you'll never know what the ingredients were that put it together. But it's one of those things like, wow, okay, that's kind of a staggering statistic if you think about it.
I saw an interview a couple of years ago on 2020 where they did three celebrities, Bill Clinton, Barbara Walters, and Robin Williams, who had open heart surgery. And the theme was how that kind of gave them a new perspective on life,
right,
and how they came through it well, and how they wanted to go on living life. And he was right there, you know, saying all of that. But yet, that's a very interesting dilemma that you can't sort of get renewed from something like that.
We are, as I said, I just want to mention mention that at the top of the show, and we'll move on to other issues.
Well, I mean, the one thing it would be sort of interesting to see what happens next. I mean, I think one of the areas I think people are going to want to explore is what kind of treatment was he getting. I mean, it's not unusual that people that have that suffer from severe bouts of depression and have various addictions contemplate suicide. That's not unheard of. What is rare is that someone actually makes it happen. And so, in this particular case, here's a guy who's, you know, very successful, very affluent, was getting treatment, and it failed. And I think that's going to be one of the interesting sort of follow-ups on this story is to what was actually, how was he being treated, and why did it fail?
I think, Joe, what was the Jimmy Kimmel line?
Jimmy Kimmel tweeted last night, and I thought this was, you know, so many of the celebrities tweeted, and most be saying, you know, beyond devastated and so forth. But Jimmy Kimmel said, Robin was as sweet a man as he was funny. If you're sad, please tell someone.
Yeah.
And I was struck by that because I thought, well, you know, that's sort of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
To know where people are and to be able to and I think you're right. If you're in rehab a month ago and you assume there are signs there to find out what kind of treatment.
And it's being reported that he was under in some sort of treatment, right? And so what happened? I mean, it sort of becomes sort of the obvious question. Now, again, it may be nothing, right? It may be one of those things that it was just terrible story that ends tragically. But my guess is that people are going to want to explore that.
But I think, you know, to Blair's point and, you know, kind of putting those thoughts together, part of the treatment, maybe the biggest part of the treatment is your interaction, you know, the interaction of the people around you, friends and loved ones. And you know, I was struck, Blair, when you were saying, you know, here's a, you know, a talented guy and everything. And yet whenever we hear about suicides, even not famous people, especially, you know, in the adolescent world, mm-hmm. and it's always, oh, you know, it was, you know, this beautiful kid with all this to live for and seemed successful. And you wonder if maybe the big unappreciated part of the treatment is the interaction with the loved ones and the one, you know, the a little bit. Sometimes we approach it with some superficiality. I have to say, you check in with a friend who you know and you say, "Hey, you doing okay?" And they're like, "Yeah, I'm okay."
And
you know, and you kind
right.
and you kind of feel like yeah. I, you know, yeah, I checked it. I checked in with Blair today, and everything. And you know, but you know, maybe we need to
probably
a little deeper than that.
Every one of his friends who's been in contact with him recently said, "If only I had said a little more. If only I had something nice, or maybe drew him out. We might have seen it." You know,
or he seemed fine.
Yeah, you know? He seemed fine. Yeah, and that is, you know, that's the real struggle. And I just feel like there was more he was going to do. I know he had a TV series last year that got canceled. It wasn't that good, but you know.
No.
It was a CBS series, so what?
As long as it wasn't a Times Union series.
Right. But,
or WMC, sorry.
I just feel like he had more greatness ahead of him. I really do. He just had so much talent, and it's just so tragic.
Well, the breadth that he had of being able to, of course, be a very funny comedian, very funny stand-up, as well as a comedic actor, and then a very good dramatic actor, winning an Academy Award for drama, you know, that's a pretty it's a varied career, and I think you're absolutely right. You can only imagine as getting older, of taking on roles. Although I was interested, I did hear this, and I had heard it prior to his passing, that one of the reasons that he was returning to television is that he said that it was difficult for him to, it was starting to become difficult for him to get roles in film. And I think that's
typecast
interesting.
A little bit,
typecast. So yeah, of finding a place for him.
Recent ones have been funny old characters. You know what
right.
I mean? Kind of not challenging, like, you know, Awakenings or Good Will Hunting. Those
or Mrs. Doubtfire.
Yeah. Right. Well, no, there was one story.
Dead Poets Society is still my favorite.
In April, some studio announced they were in talks with him to do a sequel to Mrs. Doubtfire, and that might have not been a very happy thing to think about.
Yeah.
Well, is that where my career is going?
Yeah, is that right. And also, you look at and you mentioned the crazy ones, but to have a show canceled, you know, you're the big star, you're coming on TV, it's supposed to be the big show, and then it's done. And the other thing I thought was notable was that he was a very prolific tweeter, and he would tweet several times a day, and assuming most of it was his own and not through somebody
the
else, but, right? But it was he would tweet several times a day, and so here we are on the you know, he died on the 11th of August. His last tweet was on the 30th of July. So you know, to be so prolific and do four or five a day, and then all of a sudden stop. You know, you figure that something's been kind of brewing for, obviously, been brewing for a little while. So, tragic story. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about other stories in the news. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this short break.
Support comes from Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center, a Master's in Social Work program, a personal and in-person education and advanced direct practice, hudsonvalley.adelphi.edu. TSL Time and Space Limited in Hudson, New York, screening independent films Wednesday through Saturday, Closed Curtain, Ida, and A Coffee in Berlin, timeandspace.org. Berkshire Co-op Market, Great Barrington, offering organic and local groceries, working to build a healthy and sustainable community, berkshire.coop. And Kent Hicks Construction, West Chesterfield, Massachusetts, specializing in energy-efficient, net-zero passive house home building, deep energy retrofits, and historical restorations. Serving Western Massachusetts, KentHicksConstruction.com.
Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel. I'm Joe Donahue, and I'm here with Rich Honan, Mike Spain, and Blair Horner. We welcome your comments, roundtable at WAMC.org. Under heavy pressure from the United States, Iraqi lawmakers took a significant step on Monday by choosing a replacement for Prime Minister Maliki, widely blamed for their country's polarized politics. But Mr. Maliki angrily rejected the move, vowing to fight in courts and perhaps by use of force, throwing the country into new uncertainty, even as it fights an onslaught by Sunni militants. The change in leadership could help soothe Iraq's sectarian fractures and unite the country under Mr. Maliki's nominated successor. Complicating the picture more was the United States, which helped orchestrate Mr. Maliki's rise to power 8 years ago, but now holds him responsible for alienating the country's Sunni minority and helping fuel the rise of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, the Sunni extremist group. So, when you look at this story, obviously with military intervention by the United States going on as well, where do you think we are right now, Blair?
Well, I mean, it's a depressing picture in Iraq. I mean, it hasn't gotten any better over the past number of years. I mean, I always felt sort of, I mean, clearly, Maliki has made things worse. I mean, that seems to be a well-documented fact. But the Sunni-Shia tension that exists in Iraq goes back far before him. And it's hard to believe that necessarily a coalition effort would solve that particular problem. I mean, Syria was Syria. It spills over into the borders of Iraq. Maliki has helped, and he's added some tinder to the tinderbox known as Iraq. It's going to be a huge problem to sort of deal with this going forward. Assuming he even, I mean, I was watching reports last night, he's already moved some of his military supporters to protecting the presidential palace area, also known as the Green Zone. We don't even know what's going to happen. I mean, the whole system may collapse. So it's a very scary and scary part of Iraqi history.
There's a really interesting article in the New York Times this morning about the headline is for two U.S. presidents, Iraqi leader proved a source of frustration. And the article starts off with there was this day in 2007 where George Bush and Maliki are in this video conference to sign this declaration of principles. And at the last minute, Maliki decides he's not going to sign, saying that he had not read the document's final wording. And
pretended to sign it.
Right. But didn't.
Right.
Apparently, this is what happened. He had decided not to sign because he said that he had not read the document's final wording, but he did not mention this to Mr. Bush, who had no idea his counterpart's pen had not actually touched paper. An American official in the room noticed, however, as soon as Mr. Bush's image vanished from the screen, he accosted a Maliki aide saying, "Don't screw with the President of the United States." It's so the point of the article being that he's been a very difficult person to work with, and so as this now goes on, you think, all right, but who do you get in that's
well, the
that's
new
better?
The new guy, so to speak,
yes,
Haydar al-Abadi, he was a former ally of Maliki. And he was also somebody who was an opponent of Saddam Hussein. Two of his brothers were killed by Saddam's people, and he, you know, he's trained in the West. He was an engineer, trained as an engineer in London, and he's probably got more Western orientation than Maliki had, who was very close to Iran. He might be a good person to be in there, but the problem is that Maliki, a lot of people involved in who you're going to support. It's almost like a coup. They kind of came in.
Right.
You know, Maliki's still got the military and he's got the police. And you know, it's a tough situation. I mean, what government are we supporting? We don't even know what.
Right.
We're
right.
Not sure what government, who's in power.
Rich?
And we're also asking pretty tough things. It seems like Maliki, you know, he was not the guy. Although I would challenge us all, you know, which Middle Eastern leader, you know, over the last 8 years was the guy, you know. I could see Maliki having a conversation with Obama saying, hey, listen, you guys are having trouble in your own country passing significant legislation and, you know, bringing people together, you know, just even politically. I'm fighting 2,000 years of basically tribal hatred. So maybe modify your expectations a little bit. Having said that, any new leader is not going to be a Sunni, right? Any new leader is going to be on the Shiite side. I just think that we in the West, we just have maybe by now we've learned, we just have such difficulty, or I have such difficulty understanding just the depth of the enmity there, the inability, the unwillingness to work together.
I mean, I just wanted to add I think this one little pattern, I don't know anything about this other than what I read in the media outlets, but this would be the second Western-based leader that Iraq has had, and I think to some extent, what ultimately is going to have to happen in Iraq is that somebody actually rises through the ranks that has their own base of populist support that isn't relying on their appointing their family members to head key ministries or to head the military. The key thing I thought in the Time story, Joe, was that Sistani had actually been pushing, who's the sort of the grand, the grand leader of the right. Shia movement in Iraq, was pushing for political change. And he seems like one of the genuine sort of authentic leaders of the country. Now, he's framed as he's obviously a Shia, so I don't know how the Sunnis would react to him. But there needs to be, I think, some authentic, real Iraqi to sort of emerge to lead the country. And it can't be somebody who has basically spent their entire adult lives in exile in the West.
We're out of time, but we will be back. We will continue this conversation. We welcome your input. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Good morning and welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Joe Donahue along with Blair Horner, Mike Spain, and Rich Honan joining us. We welcome your letters. Roundtable at WAMC.org. I have to say, I was just looking over. We have a couple of letters, which I'll read to in a moment, and they're I got a comment just a moment ago, and in the subject line it says Blair has flair, and I thought, oh well, that's great. It's a nice note about Blair Horner.
Uh-oh, I'm prepared. I'm sitting down, Joe. Tell me the rest.
I clicked on it, and it's for highlighters. it's a spam apparently for highlighters.
Right,
but
right.
Just so you know,
I'm feeling
I
better
care.
About myself all
we
the time.
We agree with the sentiment, though. So we're behind that.
Yes, sir.
Exactly. He does have flair. All right. So we got this letter from Diane, who says depression can be a fatal disease. Mental health medicine is in its infancy. I would think Robin Williams was receiving state-of-the-art treatment and had many caring loved ones who did everything possible. He died of a deadly disease. We also got this one from Anonymous, who says, I live with someone who is deeply depressed and is under treatment. And I never know what I will come home to. Mostly, It's that nothing is done. A talented man who had to leave a profession due to depression. It is not easy. People seem to trivialize mental illness. Maybe Robin Williams' death will help someone somewhere. We welcome your letters, roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. Let us go to some other items in the news, and we'll talk about, let's talk about the governor of New York State, who, well, he's away right now, isn't he? He's on his way to Israel.
Is that right?
Yeah. I've heard something about this.
Right,
this trip.
We talked about that yesterday a little bit. But the the question Blair brought up during the break was at this point it's not publicly known how this trip to Israel of New York's legislative leadership and the governor is being financed.
Yeah, and inquiring minds would like to know, including my own.
Wouldn't you expect that that's a question that people would immediately ask? Like.
And they know the answer. Someone knows the answer, right? Because
right.
If they're in the air, somebody paid for it. Typically, you don't go for free.
You shouldn't even have to ask. Shouldn't that be part of the information kit or the press release
that's
that
right.
goes out?
Right. Nowadays, that is the automatic question. So, yes, I agree. Right. I think that's exactly right.
And we saw it with Governor Pataki after he got elected in 95. He did a victory lap through Hungary. We found out years later that a sort of a shadowy group known as the Hungarian American Chamber of Commerce had paid for the trip. And we found out ultimately that was funded by all of the major donors in New York State that were looking for, access to the governor. In fact, one picture showed up of Philip Morris's leading lobbyists having dinner with Pataki in Budapest. And so clearly, these things don't happen by accident. And given the history in New York, you would think that the governor would want to tell us.
Right. So, that pretty much answered my question to you, which was going to be typically
well, we have like a mind meld going on.
I know it's good.
It's unbelievable.
So we have these trips. Who typically pays? But it seems to me from the answer you just gave that it can be. Let me use a technical term, squishy.
that is a technical term. I've heard that. You're right. But I mean, it's either the taxpayers, it's his campaign fund. Or
some entity that has formed to support, New York supports Israel, and then you look at who those people are, and they're probably political.
And the fact that we don't know is what makes me more suspicious, right? I mean, it's the kind of thing, as Rich mentioned earlier, you would just say it right out of the top, right out of the box.
Well, if it's your campaign money, who cares, right?
Well, I mean, again, there is then a whole issue of who are your donors? Your donors to Governor Pataki Governor Cuomo are all the largest, special interest groups in the state. That's where the money comes from. And they usually want something in return. They're not charities.
Right.
It'd be interesting to know from a political standpoint whether if some of this funding is kind of from a larger Democratic, like a Democratic organization, and you wonder, does that say something about, you would think that Democrats and Jews are fairly consistent, overlapping bases, political bases, and you're wondering if there's feeling like a need to shore that up with some of what's going on
now. That's true. I mean, the governor's ostensible argument is that he's going to Israel to show solidarity in this time of trouble. Clearly, this is a well-trod path for candidates for statewide and citywide office in New York to go to Israel, typically in election years, magically. Again, we don't know where the money's coming from. And really, the governor should tell us. It's not like he's Michael Bloomberg where he could just write the check himself.
Right.
I don't know why he feels he needs to go to this extraordinary measure for
because it's
a political
it
year.
Mike.
Well, I mean, if you look at the polls, Joe, just look at the polls.
Yes.
Does he really need this boost?
Is Astorino that far ahead in Democratic Jews that Cuomo needs to do some work on that?
Well, it's where I was going to head next. I was going to talk about the Zephyr Teachout story and then get into the poll numbers. So a New York judge on Monday rejected an attempt by the governor to block Zephyr Teachout from challenging him in the Democratic primary on September 9th. It's a 12-page ruling and found that Ms. Teachout had lived in New York consistently enough to satisfy a 5-year residency requirement detailed in the state constitution. So, Blair, what do you make of this? I mean, we always talk about the onerous election laws in New York State.
Well, it was interesting that some of the news reports pointed out that if you wanted to run for U.S. Senator, you just have to live here the day of the election. But if you want to run for New York State Governor, you have to live here 5 years in advance. The judge, I thought, correctly ruled that what really matters is that you can prove that you were living here and your intent was to live here, and she was able to prove that. But the governor, I assume the campaign here is to try to change the subject from Zephyr Teachout's attacks on the governor's record and more to focus on Zephyr Teachout herself. And I thought some of the things that came out in the judge's decision were not good from her perspective. It pointed out she hadn't paid some taxes and had to redo her her tax returns. It did sort of point out that she sort of bounced around, although I think for most people who are young and live in New York City, they can understand why that would happen. I didn't think it was a clean win for her, and the governor is using the language of the the governor's people are using the language of the judge's decision, where he talks about how even if perhaps some of her intent was to avoid having to report her activity, her taxes, for example, even though that may be the case, that didn't mean that didn't influence his decision on whether or not she was a resident. And I think the governor's people are going to seize on that and use it against her.
They have appealed the ruling, by the way. Yeah. Yes. And I mean, and the problem here is that they're trying to get her knocked off the ballot so they don't have this distraction of a primary. And who would come out to a Democratic primary in September when Governor Cuomo is, you know, seeking re-election? Probably only those who really, really, really support him and those who are really, really angry at him. And that could be embarrassing if the latter came out in great force.
And what about Randy Credico?
Oh, right. Well, he brings some comic relief to the ticket.
Well, he also allows the governor, let's say Teachout ultimately got knocked off, Credico is still on the ballot. So there would still be a primary. It allows the governor to raise even larger campaign sums, though, because if he has a primary, he's allowed to raise somewhere in the neighborhood of $16,000, up to $16,000 campaign contributions on top of the 40-some-odd thousand he's allowed to raise and for the general election. So it boosts the governor's capacity to raise money and to spend money going into the primary. And so having a Democratic opponent, but not a serious one, this would be Mike's point, I guess, would help
him. I mean, I don't know if the typical voter is even aware that there's a, you know, a separate lieutenant governor's primary, right, and they could even tell you the two candidates. So if one side is able to rally out there, this could be a repeat of that embarrassment when Al Del Bello, the Westchester County executive, ended up being the shotgun marriage ticket with Mario Cuomo back in the 80s. And they didn't even get along. They didn't even talk. Del Bello ended up quitting because he had no role. He was completely isolated from the governor. And, you know, so you could end up with possibly the governor running with a running mate who he didn't want and he doesn't want to be involved with.
Well, what is your guy's position? And I'm asking this to, you know, to Blair and Mike. It seems like we've kind of become jaded to this idea that it's okay to try to knock somebody off of the ballot, you know, from even being able to kind of plant their flag. Now, I understand, you know, if you don't get the signatures or if, you know, is this just part of the game now?
I mean, it's been this.
I know it is, but nobody even looks at it as, you know, if you're going to talk about transparency and openness and your first move is to try and knock this, you know, fairly low probability candidate off. We've just gone over the inconsistency doesn't bother us anymore.
And especially, and I'll just add to the question, especially considering Zephyr Teachout, upon her announcement for governor, said, "This is what's going to happen. He's going to do whatever he can to knock me off the ballot."
Well, I just part of the game. Points, it's always been like this. If anything, New York law has been liberalized in this area over the last 20 years. This is a game that incumbents write the rules. They don't like challengers, generally speaking, and they want to make it as tough as possible. But to just sort of follow up on why does he care so much about Zephyr Teachout when he didn't challenge Randy Credico's petitions, I think they're more worried about what Mike was talking about before, is the lieutenant governor primary. Mm. Because Kathy Hochul, who's running with the governor, is a Western New York, fairly conservative Democrat, running in a Democratic primary where the vote's going to be in New York City. She's from Western New York. Right. She's fairly conservative. She's been a bank lobbyist for the last few years, running against Mr. Net Neutrality Tim Wu. And so so you could see where a Zephyr Teachout, a strong performance on her part, could help carry Wu to victory. And where that really hurts the governor is, Hochul's his running mate on the Working Families and Independence Party lines. If she stays on those lines and Wu happened to win the Democratic primary, you can't aggregate those totals right. for the governor's win. And so he would get a much smaller margin of victory, which must drive him crazy.
That's a great point. So let's talk about, we'll take a break in just a moment, but let's just talk about the polls. So the Siena College poll comes out yesterday, and a lot of criticism against the governor over the past several days and weeks over the Moreland Commission. And so you look at this poll and say, okay, what impact has all this news had on the governor? 57% say that they will go with the governor. Still has a 32-point lead over Rob Astorino of Westchester County. So it doesn't seem as though people are really paying
Astorino
attention to
put out a press release. His campaign put out a press release yesterday after this poll came out saying that of the voters that know about the Moreland Act issues, who say they're familiar with it, they are unhappy with the governor. And they didn't, you know, although that's just a small amount, though, only a third of the people who were surveyed in this poll by Siena College are even aware of the issues around the Moreland Act panel being dismissed by the governor after it was called a year ago to clean up corruption and then abruptly ended, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, as much as it's making traction with people who know about it, not many people know about it, according to the poll.
Right. 26% for Rob Astorino. Yeah,
the governor's still doing well. He still has high approval ratings, relatively speaking. He has a huge war chest, and it's summertime. And most New Yorkers are thinking about what's going to be on the barbecue tonight and what cold beers will I drink. They're not really thinking about, you know, the Moreland Commission.
That's exactly what I'm thinking about. That's eerie, Blair.
I'm ready to leave now. And it's also sort of a murky story. Like, what is it? What really happened, right, to the average person who just gets sort of, you know, snapshots of this? The governor appointed a commission. They were going to do things, and he pulled them back, and then he got rid of them. It's not like Bridgegate. I know a lot of people want to compare it to that. Bridgegate, people understand traffic jams and that ambulances can't get through them.
Right.
In this particular case, I don't think people, unless they really study this, really understand what happened. And what really has happened is the governor just keeps making it worse. So whether or not this ultimately affects his reelection efforts, who knows? But right now, New Yorkers are thinking about the weather, thinking about the barbecue. They're not thinking about the Moreland Commission, and the governor's numbers still stay pretty high. He's got a big war chest. The two things that are interesting to me on the poll was Astorino hasn't budged. Basically, he's been where he's been the whole time. And the long-term trend on the governor's side is the part where I think they would be concerned, is that there's been slow deterioration on the governor's positive approval ratings over the past 6 months, and this trend continues.
Is that a naturally occurring event?
If you're getting beaten up in an election process, your numbers go down.
Right.
But Astorino really hasn't been able to raise much. It's just been, I think, just sort of the whatever's going on in the New Yorkers' minds, sort of a general sort of either weariness or disinterest, or maybe general unhappiness with what's going on in the state and the nation's economy. And maybe a reflection of what's going on, what we were talking about before in the Middle East, that people feel nervous, concerned, and when they get asked about incumbent politicians, and the numbers go down.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we will wrap up our conversation for this Tuesday morning. We welcome your comments as always. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this.
Support comes from Capital Cities Imported Cars, Glenmont, New York, offering new and pre-owned BMWs and Volkswagens, serving the WAMC listening area since 1975. CapitalCitiesVW.com. Chester Theater Company, presenting The Amish Project, featuring seven characters played by a single actress seeking hope in response to tragedy. August 14th through 24th, ChesterTheater.org. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery. Choose STMarys.com. And NBT Bank, offering trusted fiduciary services, investment management, and retirement planning for individuals and businesses. NBTBank.com.
Just a few minutes left before we wrap up today's panel, and we welcome your comments as always, roundtable@wamc.org. Before we go, I want to mention this story in the Times Union about Albany County lawmakers voting 21-17 to block tobacco sales in stores with pharmacies.
Yeah, it would make Albany County the first in New York State to have such a ban that would essentially, if it's signed into law by the county executive, Dan McCoy, it would next March, any place that had a pharmacy like a ShopRite or a Price Chopper or a Hannaford Market would have to stop selling cigarettes. And the supermarkets had lobbied against it. They argued that they put cigarettes away from, they close them up in containers and put them away from the public and kids aren't getting access to them or whatever. But in any event, the county executive is going to study it and have a public hearing before he makes a decision about whether he's going to, sign it into law. One of the big promoters of it was a legislator from Latham, Tim Nichols, who was also at one time a lobbyist for the American Lung Association of New York State. And he says that, it shows that Albany County is a leader in public health. And another on the legislature is a pharmacist who said that it's an ethical issue for pharmacies to not, it's where people come to get well and to get health products. They shouldn't sell tobacco. In Massachusetts, about 100 counties have already done this, and it started in San Francisco back a few years ago. So it's a trend in Albany counties, at least out in front of it. We'll have to see what happens.
The pharmacy argument is a fairly compelling one. I mean, people go to this pharmacy to pick up their prescriptions for various illnesses. Some of those illnesses could be caused by smoking. And then to have as the backdrop, as you're standing at the cash register, a whole wall, a power wall of tobacco products, I think is, you can see why people would oppose that. The question, though, is where do you draw the line? And as Mike was mentioning, Walmart has a pharmacy. Price Chopper has it. And so how do you draw those lines so that you're trying to deal with people that need therapies to get better and who may be addicted to nicotine and therefore, and they see the product every single time when they go to pay for their patch, for example. So you can see where this ethical issue comes from.
Yeah, I mean, it does raise the question how far. I think you're right. I mean, pharmacies also sell soda and cookies and
sugar products.
And people might have diabetes or other illnesses that they're coming there for. I mean, so you could continue that. But I think food is different than tobacco. And food is, tobacco hurts you. I don't think there's any question, anymore. Food in moderation is necessary to sustain.
That's right. Yeah. Tobacco, when used as directed addiction.
Yeah, I don't know that diet soda is as necessary, perspective.
Yes,
right.
For those of you who are listening, Joe picked up a Diet Coke.
Non-Bloomberg-sized
cola.
Yes. from the business perspective, it's obviously, government intrusion, run amok. I understand some of the arguments. The other business response I have to it is now it kind of seems like it opens up a lot of business opportunities because now somebody's got to sell those cigarettes. And now you wonder,
stores.
You're wondering now, are there going to be kiosks? Are they going to now be building, kind of standalone things next to the pharmacy? And is that going to, something that actually might spur some economic development?
The supermarkets may end up just sort of walling off their pharmacy areas. I mean, there are ways that you will be able to deal with this, I'm sure.
Right.
I mean, as pharmacies became, remember when I was a kid, the pharmacy was just the place you went to get medicine. And as it became a convenience store, this is where you started running into these kinds of problems. And so my guess is that if this law is held up, I mean, I don't know what's happened in Massachusetts.
They've dealt with it.
I just wonder if they portion off a portion off.
I don't believe so, but that's a good question. Make another story.
Has the effect been more marked in minority neighborhoods where maybe the pharmacy is that's where you go to buy?
Yeah,
where it become and has there been a kind of a disparate effect there.
Well, so CVS has already announced they're not going to carry tobacco products as a chain, so it is a trend.
I have two real quick questions because we're just about out of time. But one is that you always see those signs that say like CVS pharmacy department within. Is that some sort of legal? What do you know what?
Well, I assume that the pharmacy itself is definitely licensed by the state of New York, whereas the rest of the store may not be. And that may be the designation that you have to have, that you're, because the pharmacy is a licensed sort of facility.
Because the last time I went in, I got my prescription, I got a newspaper, and a beach chair. So, you know, it's like you can get sort of everything. You know,
don't forget your sunscreen.
Yeah.
You're an Irish guy, like you're supposed to have sunscreen.
Beach chairs are going to lead to too much sun. I don't. We're going to have to ban those too.
There's no exposed skin. I just wear a jacket. Blair Horner, Mike Spain, Rich Honan, thank you very much for being with us. Blair and Mike, you'll be back tomorrow. Rich, thanks as always. We'll see you soon.
See you.
Take care. Thank you very much. We'll be back after the short break.